Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Coming up, Valentine's Day is approaching and thoughts often turn to romantic relationships. But some people have deeply personal friendships, strictly platonic. We'll talk with an author who says in some cases the term best friends does not accurately describe their bond. We'll hear about a study that shows a supportive partner can improve outcomes for breast cancer survivors. We'll also remember the airline TWA, which had one of its largest hubs in St. Louis. A new book looks at the history of the airline. We'll examine full tuition scholarships. More colleges and universities are offering them, but how do they work? A marketing professor gives his thoughts on challenges for the craft beer industry and more details about the recent immigration arrests in the Chicago area and what some attorneys are saying. Those stories and more on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Marriage is held up as an ideal, but many people are in deep partnerships with friends that society does not always recognize as significant. As we get ready to commemorate Valentine's Day, which focuses on romance, we'll talk with an author about relationships that go far beyond what we typically think of as best friends. An NPR producer and author, Raina Cohen, spoke with WBEZ's Reset show about her book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center.
Now, Raina, I love your book, and one of the great things in it, as I just referenced, is all these stories of people with what you call platonic partnerships. One pair that just stuck out to me was Inez and Barb, and I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about them and their story.
So Inez and Barb met about 50 years ago, and they were working together at a point in their lives when a lot of kind of unexpected things had happened and they were reacting. Inez at that point already had two children. She had been married but decided to separate from her husband. He was sort of not a great husband and father, it turned out. Barb was back in her hometown near St. Louis, Missouri, to take care of her parents. And she had also, you know, expected to have a family, and that had not really turned out. Inez and Barb became very close at work. Barb loves children, and she's the one who does not have children and became a kind of parental figure to Inez's kids. They went on family, sort of what you would see as a family vacation together. And, you know, moving forward through time, the two women moved to different states together. The two women had houses just around the corner from each other. And then at the point where I met them a few years ago, they were living in a house that they had bought in their retirement in the hometown of Barb near St. Louis, which they share. And their bedrooms are only separated by a wall. They have taken care of each other through different forms of illness. They got each other through the pandemic, were each other's company. They have the same primary care doctor to make sure that each is sort of clued into what's happening with the other's health. They have medical and legal power of attorney rights to each other. You know, when I have gotten to speak to them and learned about their life, I mean, I think you see a friendship there that really resembles a marital relationship, except it is not recognized to be as significant in our society as a marriage, and it doesn't have the rights to go with it, but they certainly are caregivers and really partners.
Yeah, and you write a lot about how this type of relationship, like the one that Inez and Barb have, is kind of overlooked in our society, like you mentioned. You say that it's sort of hidden in plain sight because it's not as if people aren't doing these sorts of partnerships.
I think it's something that we're not used to. And one of the surprising things to me about now having the book out in the world is hearing so many stories that people have that they have had a friendship like this, or they're very close to somebody who's had a friendship like this. One thing that happens is that people don't assume that others will understand the friendship. So then they use euphemisms, or they use language that kind of shroud how close the two people are. They'll say best friend, or they'll say my cousin. They'll use kind of familial language, even if they're not officially family. And it's only when you get to dig in and have a longer conversation that you might learn that these are a friendship. So, you know, there's this kind of thing that's happening where so many people have this kind of relationship but don't think anybody else has it or will understand it, and therefore aren't talking about it. And that reinforces the idea that people don't have these sorts of friendships. And so I think that's one factor on top of this is just not what we see on our televisions, in our songs. We don't we don't sort of see representations of really strong friendships. So, yeah, romantic relationships are the kinds of relationships people ask about when you catch up after having not seen each other for a couple months. It's like, are you seeing anybody?
The term platonic partnership, you even said it's maybe not fully encompassing what is out there and what people are experiencing, and that even when the people who are in these relationships that are not romantic relationships but are so close, they don't exactly have a label for it either. So it becomes a little difficult to know exactly how to talk about it.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's another part of it, that there isn't a good label here. I mean, everybody that I spoke to had different ways of talking about their friendship. I heard platonic soulmates, best soul friend, non-romantic life partner. Inez and Barb would just say that they're best friends. You know, I think if you look at their friendship, it goes beyond what most people would think a best friend does. So that really, I think, would not tell somebody who didn't have a lot of detailed information about how close they are.
Well, Raina, we're getting some calls already from people who would like to chime in and tell us about their experience. So I'd love to go to Gigi in Irving Park. Gigi, what is on your mind today?
Yeah, I would like to just tack on to that. My name is Gigi, and I like to use the term, and a lot of my friends use the term, chosen family. And we throw that word around a lot because that is how we show up for each other. You know, when we have surgeries and need people to help us cook or bring food, we set up meal trains in our food, in our friend groups. When I had surgery on my knee, my friends took turns coming by and helping me throw out the garbage, wash dishes, do my physical therapy exercises. So using the word chosen fam shows just how important those people could be to you. And, you know, yeah, like not putting all of your eggs in one basket, expecting a relationship, a romantic relationship to fill all those needs. Like, turn to the people who have been there through thick and thin, who are always going to be there.
Raina, she talks about not putting all of her eggs in one basket, and it made me think of a part of the book where you talk about how marriage in today's society expects so much of a husband or a wife or a partner. You're supposed to be the person that fixes everything, that is the shoulder to cry on. You're supposed to make the money, take care of the kids. It's almost like marriage is asking too much. Why not lean on our friends?
Yeah, I mean, one person I interviewed described it as one-stop shopping, that people are, you know, treating their relationships like a big box store where you kind of get everything and just, you know, within a few aisles. And there is a way that that might be seen as very efficient, but also there's fragility, because if, you know, and I've witnessed this with people who I'm close to, that they put so much on their romantic relationship, and then when the relationship ended or something went wrong, they lost every important role in their life had disappeared. They no longer had their confidant or their professional coach, the person that they woke up to every day, the person who they cooked with, and so on. So there is something that's fragile about that. And I think there's something that can feel like counterintuitive to maybe a logic of like bigger is better. Like if you really love someone, then they're your best friend and you do everything with them. When actually you can kind of sabotage a relationship by asking so much of it that no one is possibly going to fulfill all that. And having other interests and people in your life can in turn make the relationship stronger. But, you know, that's not necessarily the logic that people have. And an example that I give that isn't even a relationship is my husband has gotten super into pickleball, mm-hmm. and it is like such, you know, an endorphin rush for him every time to go and play.
But maybe
and
not for
it's
you.
Just, well, I don't, I, he's very into pickleball, but I just think, I actually like, you know, joke that I think it's made our relationship better because it's a way that he, you know, gets to decompress from the stress of his work. And it's very social. He's met a lot of people. I could say like, hey, I'm not seeing you every Saturday from 3:30 to 7 because mm-hmm. you have pickleball. That's sort of a parallel to like the same thing with some people can get really envious of other types of close relationships, friendships, when they might actually make their relationship stronger.
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to go to Sarah in Brookfield, who says she puts a lot into her friendships and has 10 best friends. Sarah, tell us about that.
Hey, yeah, I have friends I've known since I was 4. I have friends from college. I have friends that I've, you know, met in the last 20 years, 10 years. I invest a lot of energy and love and time into all of my friendships, and I have the most satisfying, wonderful friendships. I can't tell you how happy it makes me because I feel close to all of them. But I am married. I'm married to an engineer who's a little bit more left brain. I'm more right brain. I think about connections and friendships, et cetera. But I do. I actively invest in my friends, and I can pick up the phone and have an incredible conversation or an incredible breakfast, and we can talk about life. And we end each conversation with, I love you so much. And it means so much to me to have them in my life. I would definitely say I've got 10 solid best friends.
That's amazing. I can't say that I have 10 best friends. I'm a little bit jealous. Raina, I wonder what your response would be to hearing from Sarah there. Does it sound like some other stories that you've heard?
One thing that stands out is, like, so many people ask me about, you know, how do you make friends? And I'm like, we should just, like, send people to Sarah. She's got it figured out. but it should not feel this unusual to hear somebody gush about their friends. And having close friends is a big determinant of lifelong health, mental and physical. We really celebrate and have lots of stories and about romantic love and the way that a family is fulfilling, a spouse is fulfilling. But the way that Sarah talked about her friends with such passion in her voice, I think a lot of people feel, and it excites me to hear it. And I want to hear these sorts of things in proportion of how many people actually feel this way.
I would love to hear about another pair that you talked with quite extensively for your book, Andrew and Tolly. And this was so interesting to me as a man who I'm, you know, 15 years into a marriage and 10 years into having kids. And it's been hard to sometimes hold on to those friendships. But Tolly and Andrew are just, they're on another level.
Yeah, they were really the first people that I spoke to. And they're two men who met when they were students, became very close in high school, and dealt with some real early difficulties together that they helped navigate, where a third very close friend of theirs passed away. And that sort of started a rhythm of them having these very regular calls. And eventually they made decisions, like big decisions for their lives, with the other person in mind, including where they would go to grad school. Part the way into grad school, Tolly transferred to move from California to Massachusetts, where Andrew lived, and then they would be in, that meant they were in the same program. They could collaborate together. They also lived together, and they have continued living together for many years across different states. And they're, you know, people haven't always understood their relationship. I think particularly because they are straight men, there's a lot of suspicion that maybe they are actually closeted. They've faced gossip. They've faced misunderstanding from their parents, which I haven't seen in quite the same degree when I talk to straight women or queer men or women, they have committed to each other, been devoted despite a lot of the misunderstanding that's directed at them.
Let's go to another call. Let's hear from Chase in Rogers Park. Chase, what's your comment today?
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to chime in with one thing that I think of when I think of, like, the partnerships and of people that I know, and also for my own life, is that, like, there's not really any legal recognition for those kinds of committed friendships, partnerships, what have you. And it's really, really challenging when you want to talk about, like, visitation rights for, like, if I'm in a hospital or, like, I don't know, healthcare. So I think that's one aspect that I wish, as a society, I guess, we actually put some legal protections behind as well.
Yeah, thanks for that, Chase. And Raina, this brings to mind several stories that you tell, including some that you term platonic parenthood, where people are kind of going through a legal process. Some of them were in Canada. I'm thinking of Linda and Natasha in particular.
Yeah, I mean, often the way that this came up was, like, people being devoted to each other and then hitting a point where the law was not recognizing that, and the lack of recognition was damaging. So Linda and Natasha, who you mentioned, Natasha decided to have a child on her own, and then Linda ended up being very involved in the child's life for years, and realized that if, you know, anything happened, that she had no legal rights to this kid who she considered her child. And then they wanted to go through, have Linda adopt the child, but then the biological mother would have had to rescind her rights as a mother, and they had to kind of do this whole legal workaround, which just sort of showed the kinds of assumptions embedded in the law that really favor marital relationships over other kinds when it comes to parenting. And with others, you know, people, I've talked to people who took care of their best friend until they died and were not entitled to family medical leave or bereavement leave after the friend died. I've talked to people who've spent thousands of dollars putting together a will to get some pretty core rights that you could get for like $30 if you were married. But these people had never considered getting married because it was not, you know, either wouldn't have been possible because one person was already married, or it just didn't feel like the appropriate relationship for them. So one of the things that I look at in the book are legal scholars who have tracked other types of structures that could exist in addition to marriage and that have and that do in different places, like domestic partnerships that could at least give some foundational benefits to people who have a close relationship, regardless of whether there's a kind of sexual or romantic component.
Another thing I'm hoping people take away is just maybe some actionable items in their everyday life. You know, what do kids get right about friendship, and how can we as adults tap into that, you think?
Well, I think a lot of adults are probably familiar with the catch-up, where you meet somebody, you know, for coffee or dinner, and you just kind of summarize what has happened in your life since the last time you saw them, which may be a few weeks or maybe months. And that's very different from the way that kids often are with each other. For, you know, they are making memories together. They are coming up with games or rituals, and they have an abundance of time. And there's often, like, they're living in closer proximity to friends, so that's possible. But I think the idea of trying to spend the precious time you have with your friends, not just sort of narrating to each other, but finding ways to live life alongside each other, making rituals together. You know, you don't have to, like, I gave a very close friend of mine a matching necklace to one that I had bought for myself to commemorate the anniversary of our friendship, which is, you know, something that you do when you're a teenager, maybe, and not as an adult. But I think that those things can still really matter to have those kinds of ceremonial forms of recognition of friendship.
That's NPR producer and author Raina Cohen. She spoke with WBEZ's Reset Show about her book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. More to come on Statewide. Stay right here.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down a road and back again. Your heart is true. You're a pal.
Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Having a romantic partner can be similar to having a best friend, someone to hold your hand through scary situations and make you laugh to ease tension, and that's especially important for breast cancer survivors. Side Effects Public Media's Elizabeth Gabriel reports on a new data analysis which found a supportive romantic partner can lead to better mental and physical health for breast cancer survivors.
Donna Wilson was diagnosed with invasive ductal carcinoma 2 years ago. It's a common type of breast cancer. Now, she's cancer-free. And Wilson credits her recovery to God, her doctors, and her partner.
Well, it was very tough for me, of course, because, of course, I've never been through anything like that. Fortunately, I do have a strong village and had Greg there with me.
She's talking about Greg Fletcher, her partner. They've been together for 11 years. One of the ways the couple spends quality time together is by watching television shows and movies.
Whatever movie we're watching, she'll be asleep within probably the half. If I'm watching something she's not interested in, she pretends to be interested in, she'll be asleep within a half hour.
I'll be asleep, but I'll wake up, you know, every so often and say, okay, what happened? So, yeah.
They say the time spent together nurtured their relationship and helped Wilson in her cancer recovery. A new data analysis of nearly 400 people shows that breast cancer survivors who don't have a satisfactory relationship are more likely to have poorer mental and physical health. Dr. Eric Bashan at Indiana University is the study's lead author.
There was worse depression in those individuals who had worse satisfaction between the survivor and their partner, and then fatigue. They also had issues with poor overall quality of sleep.
There are roughly 4 million women in the U.S. who have a history with invasive breast cancer, and research shows a third of them experience mental or emotional distress. And women of color, especially Black women, are more likely to experience these symptoms. Bashan says his study is unique because most breast cancer studies don't include partners. But he says their perspective is important because the stress of supporting a breast cancer survivor can take a toll on a partner. That can look like a lot of different things. Fletcher says as his other half was going through chemo, he was also starting to feel some of the same side effects.
You know, one afternoon I just had this chlorotic smell, couldn't get away from it. And then, you know, there was times I just felt tired. I didn't know why I was feeling tired. And so she said it's a possibility of side effects.
That, coupled with potential issues with intimacy and sexual functioning, can change a survivor's dynamic with their partner, says Becky Nappy. She's an independent licensed social worker in Ohio.
People can experience caregiver burnout because of the, you know, some of the changes in the roles and the routine, some of the caregiving responsibilities, on top of managing things that you're already managing, like work and keeping up with that. There can also be dealing with some of the financial stressors.
She says some people have to continue with hormonal treatments for potentially the rest of their life. So beating cancer isn't the end.
And oftentimes that's when you've got family and friends saying, you're a survivor, you made it through treatment, but you're still dealing with the emotional effects.
On the flip side of that, the experience of breast cancer can be a catalyst for some people to reflect on all aspects of their life and relationship dynamics. Alex Murray is a psychologist with the Cleveland Clinic's Breast Center. She says that could bring about positive change and hope.
I think that being able to kind of reflect on the cancer experience as one that could absolutely be traumatic, but can also lead to post-traumatic growth.
It's been about 5 months since Donna Wilson's last hormone therapy, and she says things are still going strong with her partner. The couple have put in the work to make sure they have a happy relationship, partially so she can stay in good health.
I would have made it through it, but, you know, I think that him being here made the world a difference.
Medical professionals recommend survivors and their partners engage in strong communication, set boundaries, and be compassionate with themselves and their partner. Elizabeth Gabriel, Side Effects Public Media.
Buffalo were slaughtered nearly to extinction in the U.S., with just a few hundred remaining by the early 1900s. Conservation efforts over the decades helped the animal rebound. Today, roughly 450,000 plains buffalo live in the U.S. in national parks, on conservation land, and on tribal lands. And as Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope reports, more and more tribal groups want to reestablish buffalo herds.
In northern Oklahoma, the Pawnee Nation has long wanted buffalo to return. Jessica Evans remembers her dad hoping for that when she was young.
It's always been an important part of, you know, Tanaha, that's what we are named for, bison. That's always been an important part of his identity. He thought that we should have them for a long time, and he's not alone.
Today, Evans is the Pawnee Nation's agriculture land manager and outreach coordinator. She says they're working to clear about 300 acres of land for a herd they hope will arrive this year. And it's no small task.
The answer is a lot of things go into trying to prepare for this because we don't want to make mistakes. This is really important.
Evan says they have been researching, attending trainings, field days, and more to make ready for the buffalo. The Pawnee Nation also joined the Intertribal Buffalo Council. The organization, started in the early 1990s, has more than 80 tribal members. Its goal? To return buffalo to tribal lands.
You know, it's real gratifying to see when we first bring back a herd to a tribe, how excited or emotional to them to finally get buffalo back on their lands.
That's Irvin Carlson, president of the council. Its members manage more than 20,000 buffalo on about 1 million acres. He says the council holds educational events and worker trainings to help more tribes and tribal nations see buffalo return to their land.
Some of the tribes don't have herds yet, but are in the process of doing that, and we help them put together getting ready to have a herd.
The Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma welcomed buffalo back to their land a couple of decades ago with help from the Intertribal Buffalo Council.
Here they go.
Lyle Washington drives a pickup truck into a field where the tribe's herd of just over 30 buffalo roam.
You do it routinely checks, just kind of inspect each and every animal.
Washington is the tribe's agricultural assistant director. He's seen the herd grow to as many as 100 buffalo. Every year, a few animals are processed for the tribe's meat distribution program.
It's real fulfilling in getting to raise and nurture these animals and see them grow and thrive and then be able to bless our tribal members with food, you know, and it's awesome.
While buffalo provided food for many tribes, they're also an integral part of multiple indigenous traditions and spirituality. The Omaha Tribe of Nebraska welcomed buffalo back in the 1980s. Justin McCallney, the director of Wildlife and Parks, says the entire community is involved with the herd.
Just seeing them is a very powerful and moving thing. We look at them as a holy animal. They're hube, you know, holy. So we do our best to take care of them every day. And, you know, in return, even to this day, they still take care of us.
And he says getting to watch each new generation of the tribe interact with the herd is priceless. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Anna Pope.
College students often use posters to help spruce up their dorm or apartment. At the University of Chicago, they get in line early for the chance to borrow works by prominent artists for a year. In the fall, Allison Cuddy brought us this report. Today, we listen back.
The small courtyard outside the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago is normally an oasis of stately trees and stunning sculptures. On this warm fall Saturday morning, it looks and sounds more like a slumber party. Clusters of students are spread out along a concrete wall, wrapped in blankets, chatting and working on their laptops. Cups of coffee and bags of food are scattered around. Rafaela Grieco Freeman was the very first to arrive. She and the other students spent the night outdoors not as part of orientation, but for a work of art, museum-quality art. Lithographs by Miro and Chagall, prints by Gordon Parks and Jenny Holzer, even a couple of Picassos.
I was like, no way this is real. Like, this is just, somebody's making something up. I'm getting fake news. And it's astonishing to be a part of this and be able to have these, like, priceless, you know, works of art and also, like, pieces of history just in a dorm room.
This annual event is not only real, it's been around since 1958, the brainchild of an alum, Joseph R. Shapiro, an avid collector and co-founder of Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art. Shapiro thought students would appreciate art if they could live with it, so he gave the university 50 works to start a lending program. The idea was a big hit from the start, and the collection grew. But in the late 1980s, it went dormant. Thanks to a new funder, it was rebooted in 2017 as Art to Live With, now run by the Smart Museum. Vanya Malloy, the Smart's director, thinks it offers students a new view on art and life.
It could be something you look at as you drink your morning coffee every day, and you see it in a different way, and maybe you notice things that you didn't before. So living with a work allows you to have this depth of experience that you wouldn't if you were just scrolling on your phone.
Any student living in campus housing can participate. Lauren Payne, who runs Art to Live With, says they do have to sign a loan agreement to keep the art for the school year.
Accidents definitely happen. You know, sometimes it might fall off the student's wall and the frame might get damaged or a hinge might get slipped. But, you know, there's never any malicious damage or anything that has been taken.
By late afternoon, the sun is beating down. Some students pass the time playing cornhole. Then the first check-in starts.
We're starting right over there.
Economics students Anwar Kul Muhammad and Rudra Patel have been waiting near the head of the line for more than 12 hours. They think they've got a good shot at their picks when the museum opens in the morning. Then Patel learns they'll go in as a group of 15.
Oh my God, bro.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I thought it was a group of like, what?
All right, group one. Everybody's here.
The next morning, they do get what they'd hoped for, an etching by one of the old masters, Francisco de Goya, and a woodblock by Japanese artist Ando Hiroshige, known for his epic landscapes. Even so, Anwar says he's not sure it was worth it.
Sleeping outside, you know, in the cold, it was just terrible. It was the worst night I've had here by far.
However, Isha Mehta did return for a second year. The economics and human rights student dressed to match her choice, a lithograph by pop artist Mel Ramos. She says the program has changed her.
And it did make me more interested in learning more about like the art and going to the Smart Museum exhibits. And it did encourage me to take a specific like art history class last year.
The future of art to live with might be up in the air. Its funding will run out after one more year. But for now, students head home, happily clutching an original artwork to hang in their dorm. For NPR News, I'm Allison Cuddy in Chicago.
Transworld Airlines had one of its largest hubs at St. Louis's Lambert International Airport. Two authors with in-depth access to the TWA corporate archives have detailed the airline's history. Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman spoke with reporter Wayne Pratt about Come Fly With Me, the Rise and Fall of Transworld Airlines.
What makes TWA so compelling to want to write a book about it?
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Transworld Airlines had one of its largest hubs at St. Louis Lambert International Airport. Two authors with in-depth access to the TWA corporate archives in St. Louis have detailed the airline's history. Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman spoke to St. Louis Public Radio's Wayne Pratt about Come Fly With Me, the Rise and Fall of Transworld Airlines.
What makes TWA so compelling to want to write a book about it?
This is Daniel. Today, many people don't even recognize the name Transworld Airlines. But in the 20th century, it was a premier airline, one of the world's largest airlines, and exemplified the new technology of air travel and the allure, the drama of air travel.
This is Alan. TWA is kind of paradigmatic of the airline history of the United States. In particular, kind of the glory days of the 1950s and the 1960s, when the airlines were really doing everything they could to make flying as enjoyable and even exciting as possible.
The airline placed one of its largest hubs in St. Louis. What was behind that decision?
Transcontinental Air Transport, or TAT. This airline was developed in late 1920s when it was still not seen as practical to fly at night. So it was an air-rail combination. So it took 48 hours to travel across the country on TAT. St. Louis was strategic for them because Charles Lindbergh was one of the key figures of TAT and, of course, very famous in St. Louis. Fast forwarding to deregulation, TWA's opportunity to consolidate their operations into St. Louis and to not try to compete in the congested hub at O'Hare in Chicago, made a very targeted effort to build up Lambert Airport as their primary domestic hub with international hub at JFK in New York.
What finally ended the airline?
Carl Icahn hammered the last nails into the coffin of TWA. All of the U.S. airlines, of course, suffered extreme financial distress as a result of airline deregulation. A number of old airlines went totally bankrupt. Perhaps the most striking of all was TWA's great rival, Pan American. TWA managed to last for another 10 years, largely through the dedication of the airline's employees, who were dedicated to trying to keep the airline going and make it survive and even succeed.
How would you describe the history of this airline in just a few short sentences?
TWA is almost like a case study of an airline that succeeded wildly early on due to the dedication and vision of its leadership, and then would persevere through a very tumultuous period in the later 20th century with leadership that was really putting other interests first besides the airline itself.
TWA was created, nurtured, and then destroyed by these three larger-than-life personalities Charles Lindbergh, of course, Howard Hughes, Carl Icahn, who kind of epitomized the greed is good culture of the 1980s. So TWA is kind of a story of these three characters who made the airline what it was and then ultimately contributed to its undoing.
Come Fly With Me, The Rise and Fall of Trans World Airlines. That is the book. Co-authors Daniel Rust and Alan Hoffman. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Wayne.
Yes, thank you.
We'll talk challenges in the craft beer industry. That's ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. St. Louis has a reputation as a beer town, but in the past several months, a handful of local breweries have filed for bankruptcy, announced they were closing, or both. Craft breweries across the country are facing headwinds. Eric Schmid talked with the marketing professor Fausto Gonzalez from Washington University. Their conversation begins with how much breweries grew over the past decade.
There was a pretty stark rise in the number of breweries throughout the country. From about 2010, when you had roughly 1,800 breweries, you saw a meteoric rise in terms of the number of breweries that were popping up throughout the country. So I think last year we saw roughly 10,000 breweries, so that's a pretty significant increase over roughly a decade or just over a decade.
So what's changed now? I mean, why are we seeing more places, at least locally in St. Louis, either closing, filing for bankruptcy? What might be driving that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it might be a little early to tell, especially because we're starting to see a little bit of a plateau in growth. Some of the people who have talked about this have cited oversaturation in the market, but then there are a number of other factors that could be playing a role.
Like what?
To some extent, there might be increased competition, and so it's making it harder for craft breweries to just compete. Some of that is competition from mass market breweries who are interested in capturing some of that demand for craft beer. But then you also have just shifting preferences and tastes. So some people who are in a younger demographic also tend to like a variety of drinks. And so some of them are gravitating towards different things like spirits or ready-to-drink cocktails or seltzers, that sort of thing.
I think there's been a lot made about younger people not being as interested maybe in drinking as much. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Overall, there's been a general shift downward in terms of the number of people who are drinking as a whole from a younger demographic. Mm-hmm. And so generally what you're seeing, I think, is not necessarily something that is specific to the craft beer industry, although there are some signs that the craft beer industry is uniquely hurting in reaction to people drinking less in general.
Yeah. How much do you feel like the pandemic plays a factor into this in terms of people reevaluating their relationship with craft beer or alcohol in general?
At least sort of just after the pandemic, there was a lot of interest in people sort of getting back out there and doing things. And I think there was a slight uptick in people sort of drinking during the pandemic. Since then, you've seen a little bit of a decrease in the number of people who report drinking frequently. And so part of it could be that they're more aware of health concerns. Interestingly enough, the cost of beer has also gone up. And so that could affect whether or not people are spending that money on beer. I think the price of beer, even in the last year, has gone up roughly 3.5%. which in comparison to things like spirits that have gone up roughly 0.1% and wine that's gone up roughly 0.6%, it's a pretty big shift for one type of drink.
So as we see this trend, is this something special to St. Louis, or are we kind of swept up in something happening more nationally?
Yeah, so the Brewers Association has suggested that, you know, there's not one region driving a change in consumption. It's interesting that we're seeing a lot of local breweries who are maybe sort of having a harder time. You're getting such different reasons for these breweries sort of either closing down or filing for bankruptcy or whatever it is. It's hard to really pin down one thing that's happening locally. Although the timing suggests that maybe there is some of this pullback in consumption happening, I wouldn't necessarily say that that's sort of a trend that's going to happen and carry through as a whole.
That's Washington University marketing professor Fausto Gonzalez discussing the problem facing some craft breweries, and he spoke with Eric Schmid. More and more Illinois colleges and universities are offering full tuition scholarships. Everyone's got one now, but as nice as zero tuition sounds, how do they work? Peter Medlin has more.
Saida Bairami is a junior at Dixon High School who spends a lot of time volunteering. She helps out at Little League games, food drives, and she's even shucked some corn.
One time that was kind of special to me, I went out to this church and we were cooking and putting together a meal to give away later. And it was just a little bit of a small group. And it was just so nice being able to sit there and do things knowing I'm helping other people out.
She says it's helped her to get to know her community, and it's also helped her earn a full tuition scholarship at Sauk Valley Community College through their Impact program. Students in Sauk Valley's district, like Bairami, sign up before their freshman year of high school. And unlike many zero tuition scholarships, there's no GPA or income requirement, but they do have to complete 25 hours of community service every year. Lori Cortez with Sauk says the Impact program launched in 2021, so the first big cohort of students will arrive at the college this summer.
We are projecting a 20% increase in enrollment because of the Impact program.
And aside from its impact on Sauk Valley, Cortez says students like Bairami have made a massive impact on the area. Since launch, students have logged over 58,000 hours of community service across 240 nonprofits.
We've had several nonprofits tell us that their nonprofit services would have been closed if it wasn't for the Impact program.
But how does Sauk Valley pay for the program? Well, Cortez says it's all local fundraising, from small family donations to an anonymous $1 million donor. Other zero tuition scholarships in Northern Illinois look very different. At Northern Illinois University, they first launched Husky Pledge back in 2019, and they funded it through a new state grant called Aim High. Husky Pledge does have GPA and family income thresholds, but NIU Sol Jensen says some of that criteria has changed quite a bit since the program started.
The income was at $75,000. Now we're up to $115,000 of a family income.
He says they could increase that income requirement because the state increased Aim High allocations. Now, these scholarships can reach middle-income students too, but it's not just public colleges and universities either. Now, North Central College, a small private university in Naperville, has a new Cardinal Pledge program. Its tagline, tuition-free, debt-free, stress-free, not too good to be true. Aggie Haney with North Central says that came from conversations with students.
They felt like it's a catch, right? It's a bait and switch of some sort. Like there's something to it. It can't be true. It's too good to be true.
She says the college did increase merit scholarship funds to help pay for it. And to meet the criteria, students must qualify for the federal Pell Grant and the state MAP Grant. Rockford Promise is yet another zero tuition scholarship, but this one is regional. As you could probably guess, it's solely for Rockford students. But Aurora Schnorr with Rockford Promise says scholarships aren't just limited to one school.
Regular graduating seniors have Rockford University, NIU, and then RVC. And then we have a transfer option that's launching this year for St. Anthony College of Nursing.
When Rockford Promise started giving out full tuition awards back in 2016, they handed out 5. Schnorr says they've grown a lot since then.
Just under 500 for how many are in school with us right now. And then I think we're at about 170 graduated.
The program operates on a variety of funding sources, from local fundraising to support from the city of Rockford. They were able to expand Rockford University scholarships this year thanks to a partnership with the city using revenue from the new Hard Rock Casino. So, do these programs save students money? Yes, they all include at least some new scholarship funding, but how much will it save them? Well, that depends on the pledge, promise, or commitment they're being made. I'm Peter Mudlin.
President Donald Trump is touting the arrests of thousands of immigrants who he says are dangerous criminals who must be deported. But some attorneys say the reality on the ground is different. They say agents in Chicago are picking up innocent immigrants, often without the required warrant. WBEZ's immigration reporter, Adriana Cardona-McGigan, has more.
Hold on, I'm gonna record these guys.
About a week ago, Eduardo Orozco noticed federal agents in his neighborhood in South Suburban Lyons. He took out his phone and started recording. He starts in a back alley and then goes around to the front of his house, where he sees the armed federal agents by his front door.
What are you doing here, bro?
Police.
Get out of my house.
Leave,
okay. Go. Okay. Go. Are you guys knocking or are you just trying to knock it down?
Is this your house?
This is my house. I live here.
What's your name?
Don't worry about my name.
Orozco asks the agents to identify themselves.
What's your name and badge number?
Okay, have a good day, all right?
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Have a good day.
That's what ICE is doing.
Orozco then follows the agents a few steps down the block where their SUV is parked. The vehicle has tinted windows, so he can't see inside. But then he realizes his dad has been arrested and is inside the SUV screaming. It's hard to hear. The sound is muffled on the video.
Huh? You know, after standing there for a second, I heard the screams of what was my father screaming, I can't breathe, I got asthma, call a lawyer.
Orozco says after the arrest, the agents took his father to McNeil Hospital in Berwyn. He says he later learned the agents were looking for a younger family member who no longer lives with them. His dad was coming home with tamales for the family. They picked him up instead.
My father, he has been here about 26 years. He has his own company. He pays his taxes. He got no criminal record. He got no DUIs, no felonies, not even a misdemeanor. He's never been arrested in his life before. He's a caregiver. He's a helper.
Orozco says the federal agents were just looking to arrest anyone.
They say, if you don't got papers, you're good for them. You're the fall guy.
He says they didn't provide any information or justification for the arrest.
They definitely did not show me any warrant. I asked for badge numbers. I asked for names. They didn't want to give me anything.
There hasn't been a single instance where the officers showed a judicial warrant.
Diana Rashid is with the National Immigrant Justice Center. She's working with 20 people who recently got arrested in the Chicago area.
They're detaining what I would call like the low-hanging fruit.
Low-hanging fruit, meaning people who were already cooperating with immigration officials and checking in with ICE regularly. She says almost half of the people her team represents have clean records. And lawyers say these arrests also appear to be in flagrant violation of the Fourth Amendment. Last week in Elgin, a resident recorded federal agents trying to get into her family's home. U.S. Marshals were looking for a family member with a criminal record, but they ended up arresting a man named Raul Lopez instead.
Let's just play some of the videos. I want you to...
I watched the footage with Alexandra Block, an attorney at the ACLU.
The screaming match that the law enforcement officers get into with the folks who are just trying to exercise their rights to ask for a warrant and ask to have the officers identify themselves and why they're there. The behavior is really unprofessional and inappropriate.
There are different kinds of arrest warrants, including a knock-and-announce warrant and a no-knock warrant.
If officers want to get permission from a judge to come into the house without knocking and announcing themselves, they have to prove to the judge why they need that ability, because it's dangerous.
So basically, if law enforcement has reason to believe that a person who's wanted for a crime is in a particular house, they have to go to a judge and swear out an affidavit that says under oath that this information is true.
The particularity is really important because it is not just a general fishing expedition. It does not give law enforcement the ability to just look for anybody in the area. They have to tell the judge who they're looking for and why, and it has to meet a standard of probable cause.
Block says what she sees in the video is not the way law enforcement agents should conduct themselves.
When you see the militaristic gear, the tactical gear, the gun pointed at people's faces, they're doing it to intimidate, to instill fear, and to, you know, in some ways sort of make this political theater. They're trying to scare other people in the process of arresting a few people, and that's really unfortunate.
Back in Lyons, Orozco is afraid.
When I'm inside, I'm like living with fear now, even to be in my own house. I gotta, you know, you see how I'm looking out the windows, right? I mean, I shouldn't have to be peeking out my windows without people having to see me to see who's out there, you know, because I'm scared to come out.
His entire family, his mother, his wife and two children, he says, are physically and emotionally distressed. As far as President Trump's so-called crackdown on dangerous immigrants, Orozco says it's a publicity stunt, and people like his father are paying the price.
He owns his company, and, you know, he got his workers. So now the other workers, they're not working right now. Bills are coming in, rent's coming in, the world keeps on going.
These raids, Orozco says, are not just hurting a few families, but instead an entire community. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find our episodes where you get your podcast through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.